the Federal Reserve and its balance sheet, self-driving cars, and a little bit of beer. Not together, those last two. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, 31 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with debt and a couple of buzzwords. First, the debt, lots and lots of it, the mortgage-backed securities and government bonds that the Federal Reserve has been buying up and mostly holding on to since the financial crisis. Here then is buzzword number one. The buying up of that debt was called quantitative easing, because with interest rates already at zero, the Fed was trying to get more and more cash into the economy. Only in the past year or so has the Fed started selling off its balance sheet, a financial maneuver called, and here comes buzzword number two, quantitative tightening, selling its securities to get cash out of the economy. Up till the Fed's meeting the past couple of days, we had been expecting that selling to continue pretty much on a regular schedule, because that's what Fed Chair Jay Powell had told us he was going to do. Yesterday, though, with some economic softness lurking, Powell said he is open to the idea of that pile of securities just sitting there for a while. Might sound, arcane and complicated, and it kind of is, but it's a big deal. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The Fed has $4 trillion worth of securities, bonds, treasuries, just sitting there like a big old treasure pile. I mean, technically, they're in computers, I guess. But anyway, it has this giant pile. As some of those bonds matured, it bought new ones, keeping the pile going. And then a year and a half ago, it said, okay, we're going to stop buying new ones.
It was very big deal.
Rick Reeder is chief investment officer with BlackRock. While the Fed was not buying new long-term bonds, the Treasury Department started to sell tons of them to pay for tax cuts and stimulus and government expenses. So, law of supply and demand, lots of bonds out there. The prices fell. Yields rose. Bonds looked like a great deal. Such a good deal that investors said,
why would I buy any other asset? And it was creating this real pressure on other assets.
So stocks and other investments took a hit, and investors basically were worried that the Fed just didn't care, that the Fed would just keep on raising bond yields and interest rates no matter what.
That was not the Fed's plan.
Seth Carpenter is chief economist at UBS.
So they wanted to make sure they corrected that impression by saying, no, we're paying attention to what's going on everywhere in the economy, including in financial markets. And if the world changes, our plan will change.
So the Fed said it would be flexible about what it did based on economic conditions.
The markets unanimously celebrated, you know, the slight tonal shift of the Fed.
Jay Jacobs is head of research and strategy at Global X. So the Fed is maybe one less thing for markets to worry about for now. Trade wars, government debt, growth slowdowns, those things are all still there. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There is news that Foxconn, best known as a key Apple manufacturer, is backing away from a much publicized promise to build LCD screens at a plant in southeastern Wisconsin. The announcement came as no surprise to skeptics of that deal, which was first announced in 2017 to great fanfare at the White House. The Taiwanese electronics manufacturer has made and then walked away from big promises before. Foxconn had pledged that the Wisconsin plant would create 13,000 jobs, most of them low-skilled and on the factory floor. Now, though, the company says it's just not profitable to build TV screens in the United States, so it'll focus instead on building something called an advanced manufacturing facility with far fewer workers. Politics of that deal aside, this whole thing says something about the state of manufacturing in this country. Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us what it does say.
A Taiwanese company building TV screens in Wisconsin never really made sense to Brad DeLong, an economist at UC Berkeley. He says jobs at Foxconn's factories require a lot of tedious work by hand for relatively low pay.
In a world in which China's wages are a fifth of ours, and there are lots of other countries whose wages are less than that, those aren't the kind of manufacturing jobs we are going to have in the United States ever again.
So what kind of jobs are we going to have? DeLong says more like the ones Foxconn is talking about now, scientists and engineers. Susan Lund, a partner at the McKinsey Global Institute, says technical skills, programming the robots and fixing machines when they break down, are in high demand.
When you look at the kinds of goods that are being made, it's a lot of what we call advanced industries. So aerospace, automotive, very sophisticated products like medical devices.
But something else may be holding back the U.S. manufacturing sector. Rob Scott, a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, says the problem is the strong dollar.
We have allowed our exchange rate to become simply totally incompetitive. The dollar is overvalued, by my estimates, by between 25 and 30%.
Bringing it down would make our exports less expensive. That would increase demand, which he says could create millions of new manufacturing jobs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not so bad. All in, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So let me ask you this. You've got a job, you like it well enough, or maybe you even love it. And then one day, in a move that everybody saw coming but that nobody really believed would actually come, your company locks you out. And not only does it lock you out, it doesn't pay you for a month. You see where I'm going, right? While we wait for Congress and the White House to figure out whether there's going to be another shutdown in a couple of weeks, and we should say here the tweeted indications this morning don't look promising, there is a workplace morale part of this story that ought to be told. Because for a whole lot of government workers, that morale is lousy. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson talked to some people.
Without work, without a paycheck, government workers had to take a long, hard look at their financial lives, and they had lots of time to contemplate their options.
I'm already thinking ahead to plan for what happens if we go down again in the middle of February.
Jeffrey Craven does statistical modeling for the National Weather Service. He's already gotten his back pay, a huge relief, and he was able to make his February mortgage payment on time. He said morale around the office is actually better than he expected. But he says this shutdown, he's been through others before, but this one was life-changing.
We all got a wake-up call. You know, those 800,000 people got a wake-up call that you shouldn't take job security for granted.
Craven's 52, not ready or able to retire yet, but he got back to work and applied for retirement training, counseling to help him better understand his retirement benefits and options.
That was kind of surreal to me. I would probably work to 62 without even thinking about it, but now I think I would actually consider retiring earlier.
Maybe picking up some part-time consulting work.
I never had thoughts like this back prior to December.
Jerry Stevenson is a research scientist in Houston. We spoke during the shutdown when she was pinching pennies, literally turning in coins for cash, and rethinking a career in public service.
And I keep wondering if this is where I really want to be, working in the government. I did military service, and I can transition that service over into my retirement with the government. So that's kind of always been my thought, is that I would retire with the government.
Because Stevenson really likes her job.
Absolutely love everything about it. But then I'm thinking, well, you know, if this is not going to provide the stability that I need, is this really where I need to be right now?
The recruiting site Glassdoor found the number of federal workers looking for new jobs jumped 10% after that first missed paycheck in early January, compared with the same time last year. Some agencies saw bigger jumps. For example, there was a 50% increase for TSA workers looking for new jobs. And this isn't just about current employees. Daniel Zhao is a senior economist at Glassdoor.
There's certainly a long-term risk to the federal government's ability to attract and retain talent.
That attract piece, the government's ability to hire new workers, that might be even more significant. During the shutdown, Glassdoor also tracked a 46% drop in applications to open positions at federal agencies. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
New cars nowadays are really just a bunch of computers, right, on wheels. All the sensors and driver assist bells and whistles, the automatic braking and the lane keeping, they're getting us closer and closer to fully driverless cars. Till then, there is human error to account for. A couple of weeks ago, Marketplace's Ben Bradford did a story on how drivers misunderstand and sometimes misuse car technology. Today, the high cost of fixing those cars when humans get involved.
Last winter, Baltimore resident Adam Richardson found a 6-inch long crack in the windshield of his 2017 Ford Fusion.
I didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal.
He thought a couple $100, but then he called an auto glass company.
And said, hey, I've got this crack. Here's the make and model of my car. And they said, oh.
Not a great sound. See, Richardson's car has front collision sensors behind the windshield. Replacement glass that's different thickness or clarity can cause them to malfunction. So Richardson had to buy manufacturer-approved glass and then have the sensors recalibrated to work properly.
It ended up being somewhere north of 700, so that was definitely a lot more than I'd anticipated.
And more than at least one in three drivers can afford for an unexpected bill, according to AAA. The organization also recently found that cars with advanced safety features commonly cost twice as much to repair as lower-tech vehicles. Janet Gonzalez-King owns Innovative Auto Collision, a small auto body shop in South Los Angeles. She's unscrewing the bumper of an Audi Q7 SUV loaded with advanced features, auto-dimming headlights, adaptive cruise control sensors, and then...
You have this.
King holds up a black tangle of plastic and wiring. It's from the cracked side view mirror, which has blind spot detectors and tech for defogging and power folding. King says the replacement cost can come as a shock.
It's heartbreaking to call a customer, especially when they're paying out of pocket and saying, hey, the mirror that I quoted you, it amounts to almost $2,000.
The cost of insurance has also increased, almost 20% from 2010 to 2016, per the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Some insurers have cited the higher repair cost of advanced features. Shops like King's have to adapt to new costs, too. She outsources the work of calibrating sensors. Others are investing in expensive equipment and training.
It's changed the whole way you do business.
Kai Young owns European Motor Car Works in Orange County. He's been fixing cars for 42 years.
When I first opened up, all you needed was a spray gun, a hammer, a dolly. Nowadays, it's millions of dollars investment.
And a lot of computer work. Young son-in-law Mike Hubbard works on a Tesla missing its front fender. He sits in the driver's seat, holding a laptop with a cable dangling from it.
We'll just hook it up under the dash.
He's checking the condition of sensors and electronics.
And then as soon as this boots up, we'll hook up and you'll actually see it.
Up pops a list of all the car's features with codes describing their status. Each car maker, and sometimes car, requires its own software and hardware. A new windshield might also require a wheel alignment, so the car drives straight before the cameras are reset.
These systems, they are exact. And if something's out of whack or something isn't recalibrated, you can be talking somebody's life.
Young says repairs related to advanced safety features make up at least 20% of his billings. But insurance companies can be reluctant to cover the extra cost. Young says he can spend as much time arguing with insurers about the cost of recalibration as working on the car.
It's not, at this point, in my opinion, a big profit area. It's a necessity that we have to perform.
A growing necessity. By 2022, nearly every new car sold in the U.S. will have front collision sensors. That'll help prevent crashes, but it means the fender benders that do happen will cost thousands of dollars to fix. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
For the foreseeable future, anyway, no matter how autonomous a car is, most of them are going to be gasoline-powered. So, on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow, wither big oil as the global economy slows. Coming up.
I mean, this January, you couldn't pass a bus stop without there being an advert for one or another alcohol-free beer.
Taking your New Year's resolutions seriously. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 15 points today. That's less than a tenth percent, 24,999. The NASDAQ picked up 98 points, 1.3%, 72.81. The S&P 500 found 23 points, 0.8%, 27.04. Amazon did well during the session, but fell in after-hours trading after forecasting first-quarter sales below Wall Street estimates. The company says it's facing regulatory hurdles in India and a slowdown in sales in Europe. Facebook shares up 10.8% today after the social media company posted quarterly earnings well above expectations after the bell yesterday. Delivery giant UPS jumped 4.1% after it saying it carried more packages and benefited from higher prices from shipments in the fourth quarter. UPS also said it expects improvement in its bottom line through 2019. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get this, 2.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two trade items upon which to touch today. Day two of trade talks with China. No big news to report there. The hard deadline, according to the White House, still March the 1st on new tariffs. Also, new NAFTA, officially the USMCA, has hit a couple of snags in the ratification process. So at the macro level, kind of the same old, same old. For people actually trying to make a living in the trade economy, though, the uncertainty continues. We got our apple farmer, Patrick Smith, up in Yakima, Washington, on the phone to talk things over. Hey, Patrick, it's Kai. How are you?
Hey, Kai. Good. How are you?
Good, good, good. You rolling on your end? You hit that little record button already?
Yep. All right. We are recording and on the way.
All right, good. So how are things? I mean, here you are once again, sort of the guy in the middle of a couple of trade things, the China thing, the NAFTA thing, the renegotiation thing. I mean, it's a mess for you.
Yeah. It's been a long, you know, slog over the last few months here. And until the new NAFTA talks and the China talks, you know, have some sort of resolution and the tariffs get lifted, we continue to have pretty strong headwinds in moving our products into those markets. And it doesn't seem like there's a resolution coming in anytime soon.
Without getting into actual dollars and cents, because that's none of my business, but how much has the last, how long have we been doing this? Like 8-9 months now? How, like on a percentage basis, how much has it cost you?
So our Apple exports had grown 34% over the prior 2 years, and subsequently now are down 29% this year. The four largest markets for Washington Apple exports are Mexico, Canada, India, and China and Taiwan. Wow. And those markets collectively are down 30%. They represent about 70% of our total exports. Tensions between the countries on trade has had a very noticeable impact on our ability to move product in there. And some of it also, of course, is the strength of the dollar, which is a consequence of these trade wars.
You and Tim Cook, he was complaining about the strong dollar the other day.
Yeah, it's the same story. For Apple and apples.
look at that. We made a global trade joke.
Yeah, exactly. So full circle.
So if this goes on now for whoever knows how much longer it's going to go on, what are you going to do, Patrick?
That's a good question. The hard part is that, you know, our industry right now is in as precarious of a place as it's been in many years. Prices just generally are poor. You know, we're obviously having trouble with exports. Yeah. Costs continue to go up, driven in large part by labor. I think every apple grower in the state of Washington is, you know, thinking these same things. Yeah. But we're not really getting much help. You know, we're not part of the market facilitation program that USDA has put out. We're just kind of on our own in a way, it seems like.
Yeah. Just for the beer aficionados among us, people will remember that you grow hops up there as well. How's that side of the business doing?
That side of the business is a bit better than apples at this point. The craft beer industry here in the U.S. Continues to drive some growth there. Keep drinking IPA. I know how much you like IPA.
I will.
But about 50 to 60% of our production in the hop industry is exported. And so while we haven't been hit with tariffs, we are feeling the impact of the strong dollar and the, you know, just general trade tensions between the U.S. and other countries. And I think that that's having an impact there as well.
Patrick Smith, he and his family run Loftus Ranches up in Yakima, Washington. They make beer, too, actually, for what it's worth. Good beer.
We do make beer.
Patrick, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Kai. Appreciate it.
For those who've been participating in Dry January, today is it. You made it a full month without a tipple. Over in the UK, whence the idea of starting the New Year Dry started, more than 4 million people went without this year. That's up 33% from a year ago. Seems avoiding booze is becoming more popular there, and not just in January either. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London, that is creating some business opportunities.
The name of this alcohol-free restaurant bar might suggest a rather straight-laced attitude to booze. It's called Redemption, but co-owner Catherine Solway, herself a pastor's daughter, insists that she and her business partner, Andrea, are not holier than thou.
We are not clean, living, perfect ladies. It's been our redemption. So it's about giving people a chance to cleanse, but nobody's perfect. In fact, in order to be redeemed, you have to have sinned, right?
The two women now have three flourishing restaurant bars that avoid what they call toxins and temptations. No meat, no dairy, no chemical additives, no sugar, and most controversially by far, no booze.
When we first started 5 years ago, everybody said, an alcohol-free bar restaurant, are you guys literally mad? Why would I want to go there?
Britain is still a hard-drinking country. Many Brits drink to get drunk. But as elsewhere in the West, alcohol consumption is declining. 20% of 16 to 24-year-old Brits are teetotal. And here's another company that's profiting from that trend. The Nirvana Microbrewery in East London, the UK's first alcohol-free craft beer producer. The inspiration for starting the business 3 years ago, says owner Becky Keane, was her own father.
He's a recovered alcoholic who has now used alcohol-free beer as a way of helping him in his recovery.
But he complained the only alcohol-free beers on sale at the time were pretty awful.
So we went out looking to make something better.
Is he your official taster?
Yes. Back? Yeah, he's our number one customer. Yeah, no, he always taste tests all of our beers.
8 years ago, there were only two or three alcohol-free beers on sale in Britain. Now there are hundreds of them, widely available online, in supermarkets and in bars.
Can I order an alcohol-free St. Peter's without and a Big Drop Pale Ale?
And some of those beers are very good indeed.
And then it's got a very malty taste, this one, and a slight sweetness on the finish. It's a really beautiful beer.
That's Laura Willoughby, who runs Club Soda, a group that advises people on moderate or mindful drinking and tries to persuade the drinks industry to cater for alcohol-avoiding customers. The message is definitely getting across.
I mean, this January, you couldn't pass a bus stop without there being an advert for one or another alcohol-free beer. The market's adapting, the big boys are getting in there, and they're beginning to bring new brands to market very quickly. And so we're now seeing this rise of an alcohol-free drink sector.
It's still only 10% of the whole drinks market, but it's the fastest growing segment and includes alcohol-free spirits and wine as well. Richard Piper of Alcohol Change, which combats the harm caused by booze, warmly applauds this development.
We are very excited about this growth in the low alcohol, no alcohol market because we see it as a really important element in attracting people to healthier alternatives.
Economically healthier too, he says, quite apart from the human and social damage caused by alcohol abuse, the financial cost in Britain's state-funded healthcare, policing and other public services runs to a staggering $13 billion a year. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I offer in spite of myself. Columnist Mac Engel of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram had a doozy today in which he points out that the new manager of the last place finishing Texas Rangers baseball club has decided that his team ought to start eating the way Tom Brady eats. Yes, that Tom Brady, 41-year-old umpteen Super Bowl winning New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. Apparently, you can buy Brady's meal plan on his website if you must, because to quote Mac Engel, if you are unaware of the diet assembled and followed by the quarterback of the New England Patriots, picture riding on a roller coaster. Now take out all the fun. Go Rams. That was me. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's down 15 points today. That's less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ up 98, 1.3%. The S&P 500 found 23 points, 0.8%. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Aaron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.